recorded in Indianapolis, Indiana. Welcome to the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Melillo. This show features real-life stories of Indiana's most infamous horrors, Circle City serial killers, and crimes, both current and cold. I sit down and interview people who know these crimes the best. Sometimes they're authors, sometimes law enforcement, and even family members of the victims. In the end, you'll see a darker side of Hoosier hospitality. Hey everybody, it's Joe from the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm your fearless host, and this week we're getting right into it. No intro, because frankly, this man needs no intro in our podcast. He is the host of the 3C's Podcast, also known as Circle City Crime. We are live, well, recording, in the Indianapolis Downtown Public Library. It's about to snow outside. We're here together. Chris met me here because one, it's a great place to record. We figured it would be quiet, but also, more importantly, this is where his research for his podcast began with his wife. So we are more than happy to bring you here with us. Thanks again for joining us. And Chris, thanks for meeting me.
Hey, thanks a lot for having us on, Joe.
3C's Podcast, we're going to go over where the idea came from, but ultimately, you started because you live in Speedway, Indiana. And as we know on this podcast, Speedway, Indiana has been home to some of the craziest crimes in history, especially in Indianapolis history. What got you going? What was the reason why you wanted to start looking into your main case, which was the Burger Chef murders?
So not long after moving to the Speedway area, I learned about the case and realized that just how close some of the landmarks were, the actual Burger Chef building where the crime took place and the high school where one of the victims attended, and it's just something I couldn't get out of my head. So we found a Facebook group online and started following and interacting there, and that turned into researching other sources like the newspapers here at the library and finding out that some of the information that was out there publicly was incomplete or just flat out inaccurate, especially some of the stuff that was ending up on other podcasts.
You know, one of the first times I ran into the Burger Chef murders was doing a report about the 40th anniversary. And police, if you remember, state police at the State Police Museum actually held a press conference where some of the family members of the victims came forth and said, you know, don't give up on this. Let us know. And I feel like that resonated with you and your wife and the reason why you do your podcast.
It did. It's a sensitive thing. You know, I've always been a listener of true crime podcasts, and you always hope that the family is okay with the reminders and everything. I think a lot of the podcasters have good intentions when they retell these stories, but for us, it was important to know that there were family members and friends of the victims that did want this story to continue to be told and ultimately did want answers in this.
Well, answers have been hard to come by for sure. Let's go over for our viewers a little bit about the basics of this case. You're an expert, I would consider, at this point. So why don't you tell the viewers what they need to know about the basics of the case?
Sure. And, you know, I hesitate to call myself an expert, but the one thing that I do try to do is...
I called you an expert.
Right. The one thing I really do try to do is not pass something off as true if it's not. You know, when I retell the facts of the case, I try to stick to the things that I've been able to corroborate through not only newspaper articles, but previous investigators, as well as employees from the Burger Chef and witnesses from the time. So kind of the way it went down, there were four employees that were on the closing shift at Burger Chef. It was 1978, November 17th. It was a Friday night. Kind of a normal, you know, November weather night. Wasn't rainy, wasn't snowy, but it was cold. You know, what you'd expect in Indiana. Not a busy night at the restaurant, and there were three teenagers, Mark Flemons, Daniel Davis, and Ruth Ellen Shelton working, and then the manager on duty was 20-year-old Jane Freet. At some point after they closed, and the best we've been able to narrow it down based on witness reports is sometime between 11:20 and 11:50, and the restaurant closed at 11, someone or multiple someones came, took all four employees, $581 in cash, took them from the restaurant, left the restaurant open, unlocked, lights on, fans running, and drove all four employees eventually down to Johnson County near the intersection of 37 and Stones Crossing Road, where they killed all four of them, and then the bodies were found about 36 hours later.
Tell us a little bit about how they were killed.
So this is something that we spent a lot of time on, and it's, you know, not a fun thing to really dive into, but they were killed in three different ways. Two of the victims, Ruth Shelton and Daniel Davis, were lying face down in the field, and they had been shot three times each in the back of the head. Jane Freet had ended up roughly 75 yards from those two, and she had been stabbed twice in the chest, and the knife blade had actually broken off in her chest. And you mentioned the press conference that the state police did back in November of 2018, and they actually showed a picture, finally, of the blade of that knife to give the public another clue to try to get to the answers on. And then finally, Mark Flemons had ended up about 75 yards in the opposite direction of Jane Freet, and he had been beaten to death. And actually, it appears as though he had fallen in a position where he wasn't actually dead when the culprits left the scene, but he actually choked on his own blood about 20 minutes later.
It really rocked the community of Speedway, and for many of the people that I've talked to from Speedway about this incident, you know, what's interesting is that that time period was very safe. You left your doors unlocked, you left your car unlocked, you trusted who you were living down the street from. You know, it was a quiet community. I think it had like one or two homicides in the history up to that point or something, and they were very like random homicides. This was a time where, man, 1978, people are like, you know, we know it now because we look into it, but there was a lot of crime going on. But this specific town of Speedway didn't really live that way. They felt safe. So having this kind of shocked the community. What have you talked to about the witnesses about that?
So it's been an interesting discovery for us. A lot of people do reference it as a very safe time in Speedway. In fact, there was a series of 8 bombings that took place just before the Burger Chef murders. And when we talked to people about those bombings, they're very nonchalant, as if they weren't afraid that that was going on in the town. It's been one of the wildest conversations I've had. But what I will say is the feelings of these residents of Speedway don't actually compare quite to what you read in the news was really getting underway in Speedway at the time. It was actually beginning to become a very tumultuous time. We had the bombings. There was a man arrested for those bombings, and he did serve time in prison. One man was injured severely, lost his leg, and then through, I don't think necessarily complications from that injuries, but just depression and everything following that, he actually did die a couple years later. But we also have found that there was a lot of drug activity beginning to go on in Speedway at the time. Mm. And in fact, there was a motel right across from the Burger Chef restaurant that housed a lot of motorcycle club members and drug dealers. They would have regular rooms there and were operating out of that. And then there was an apartment complex that actually one of the victims lived in called Big Eagle, that we've heard stories of drug parties and people cooking the precursor to what we know now as meth, even back in 1978 in Speedway. So,
man, that must have been pretty hefty area to be hanging out in. So for these kids to kind of just be plopped right in the middle of it, even though they were good kids, from at least what the family members say, you know, they were really good kids. They were just teenagers working their first job, just like a lot of us did when we grew up. So to have this happen to them and randomly, I mean, obviously it was a huge shock. So what's really interesting to me, and what I think your research does a really good job, is it puts it into a real light as opposed to maybe one or two sources. How many sources have you talked to? Tell us a little bit about that research.
So, I mean, if I were to put a number to it, it would be in the dozens in terms of individuals we've spoken to. And that's trying to get a feel for the time from people who were not involved in the crime any at all, but simply, you know, just knew the time and knew the place, to friends and family members of the victims, previous investigators. I tracked one previous I've tracked one previous investigator all the way down to Florida, and he spent several hours on the phone with me, you know, recalling everything he would recall. I spoke with Virgil Vandegrift, who you spoke to when you were doing the Herb Baumeister research. So definitely dozens of people, hundreds of newspaper articles, books, other podcasts. I mean, anything I can get my hands on. I think it's important to get everything as factually correct as possible. That's our main goal, is to just be a compilation of facts. Maybe somebody else can do something with it down the road.
What are some of the main things do you think people could connect themselves to that wouldn't spark that memory, that could help break a case like this open? What are you seeing?
So, you know, as we mentioned, well, let me back up. The biggest theory for a long time from the state police on this case has been that it was a robbery gone wrong. And while I'm in no position to say unequivocally it was or it was not, we feel that it was not. There was just so much violence associated with this case that it doesn't seem to play out the way that you would expect a scenario like that to play out. But what has happened is, because that has been the largely accepted narrative, is the public has really kind of closed their eyes to other possibilities and stopped thinking about what was actually going on in their lives at the time. So, you know, just the general things. If there was someone in your life who underwent a major change, started acting differently, moved away, cut their hair, you know, changed jobs, changed vehicles, those kind of things, obviously. Mm. And again, we're talking about November 1978.
I mean, I can barely remember lunch, let alone 40 years ago. I mean, this is difficult stuff that you're doing.
You would be absolutely shocked, the people that have such vivid memories. It's really blown me away. And I'll get caught up in talking to people about the nostalgia of the time and, you know, talking about restaurants that were, you know, in their heyday back then, like John's Famous Stews, mm-hmm. and the Burger Chef itself. It seems like everybody I've talked to knew someone who worked at themselves a Burger Chef at some point. But
and Burger Chef is now Hardee's, right?
So it was bought out by Hardee's. Officially, they've closed all of the locations that were a Burger Chef. Now, the one on Crawfordsville Road where this took place, it did become a Hardee's for a few years, and then they relocated the Hardee's. It's an empty building now. But yeah, it's, that building and the franchise itself have been through a lot of iterations since this all happened in 1978.
It was a popular spot too. You know, it wasn't like it was just like a, you know, McDonald's on the corner that everybody would drive by, but this was a place that kids used to hang out and people used to go to. Is that right?
Yeah. So I don't know so much about this particular one, mm-hmm. but it yes, Burger Chef restaurants and their parking lots were hangouts. You know, they had all the hot toys. I mean, they were the first ones to bring about something like a kid's meal.
Mm.
So they were, you know, they had the cheap meal with the toy, and they were one of the first restaurants to have those Star Wars 1 collectible type cups and toys and things before, you know, the other restaurants really caught on that Star Wars is going to be a hit.
Imagine a Burger Chef Star Wars figure today, how much that's worth.
You know, there's a lot of Burger Chef memorabilia out there, and you can find it on eBay. It's some of it's really expensive, and some of it, but it's more than anything, it's rare. I mean, people had no idea. This was a booming restaurant chain. There were almost 1,000 locations back in the 70s, so nobody had any idea that by, I think it was 1996, it would be completely defunct.
So let's go back to the day again. You know, you kind of gave us the basics, but walk us through the timeline of what you think happened, or I guess what we can prove at this point. And this is based off state police records, as well as the research you've done with these witnesses and people who have known those victims. By the way, I just still can't believe that this is unsolved, folks. Like, let's listen up here a little and try to put our brains to it. If you remember 40 years ago, if you're someone who's listening who's older, you probably can put yourself back there. Just try to listen and try to figure this out. So, the day is November 17th, right?
Yep.
And we're hitting it. We're going to work, and it's a regular day, right?
Yeah. So you know, one of the victims had switched shifts with another employee, so that employee could go on a date with a third employee. And that they actually helped create some of our timeline. A lot of this is found in early newspaper articles, but we were lucky enough to speak with both of these employees as well. And what they say is that towards the end of their date, just based on the area that they were and then that the young man was taking the girl home, they drove by the Burger Chef restaurant sometime between roughly 11:45 and 11:50. And at that point, they noticed that, or the female employee says at this point, she noticed that all of the lights were still on, but the assistant manager, Jane Freet's car was gone, and that struck her as odd. She says that the male employee asked if she wanted to stop, and she said, no, my dad's a real stickler about the midnight curfew, mm-hmm. so you've got to get me home. He actually already had plans to go back and help them close anyway, because another employee was supposed to have left at 10:30. Sadly, this is probably one of the saddest things I've discovered in our research, is that young man, wanting to make more money for, you know, the upcoming Christmas shopping season, had called his mother and asked her to stay past that 10:30 time. It's impossible to say for sure, but, you know, had he left at 10:30, you know, likely he would have survived that scenario. So the other employee returns, and I always try to point this out, because in some retellings of this, it's been mentioned that it was a delivery person or different things. It was an employee, a 17-year-old employee. He wasn't on shift that night, but he had agreed to come back and help. And he arrives around 12:05, sees that the back door is ajar as he's driving around the restaurant, finds that odd, but chooses to go in that door because it's already open. He wouldn't have to go to the side door and knock or anything.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when he opens it, there's nobody inside. Here's no chatter. Here's no clanging of dishes being cleaned or anything. Simply here's the fans and nothing else.
Oh my God, that is creepy.
I've talked to him several times, and I really still can't to this day put myself in that scenario and imagine anything I've gone through that would be quite so eerie. But he does say that upon entering, he didn't realize it was as bad as, you know, as it turned out to be. But he knows something's off. The trash can is by the door, empty. There's a cash drawer on the floor. There's two jackets on the floor. He doesn't say that he remembers this.
Were those jackets Burger Chef jackets, or were they just random?
So they weren't Burger Chef jackets, but they were the jackets belonging to the two female victims.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And he doesn't say he remembers this specifically, but newspaper reports in the early days do state that there was a purse left behind. So all these things added up to be kind of odd. So he actually, the first thing he does is calls a former manager who he believes might know the whereabouts of Jane Freet a little better. And he says, no, I have no idea. Call the police. So the young man calls the police. Speedway police show up fairly quickly. This is one thing I always like to touch on, too. A lot of people bang really hard on the Speedway police for basically doing nothing that night, which they essentially did. They came, they took a couple statements. They didn't lock up the scene. They didn't, you know, prevent people from coming back to the scene. They really didn't take it all that seriously at all. They thought that the four employees had taken the money and run off. And by the time they realized something was serious and that the kids never returned home or didn't return back to work the next morning, the morning shift employees had come in and cleaned up the restaurant. My belief is that there wouldn't have been much information for them or evidence for them to find anyway.
Yeah, that's a major point here. This is something that's something that as investigators and people who research this case talk about a lot. That even though the morning shift came in there, there's no guarantee that the evidence that they cleaned up would have led to an answer in this case. It wouldn't have hurt, but
sure,
and that's just part of life sometimes, you know, a part of all this.
They certainly didn't do the right thing, but I don't think the case was, you know, torpedoed at that moment when they decided to, allow the restaurant to be cleaned up. There were no signs of a struggle. There was no blood on the floors or the walls or the door handles or anything to really make them worry that first night. So I don't know, other than some fingerprints possibly on the cash drawer, which I've always wanted to know, did they still go back in and fingerprint some areas? Because one of the weirdest parts about this story is they actually did go back and recreate the crime scene the next morning.
After they cleaned it up.
As far as where the jackets were, even down to a cup that was sitting on a table. One of the investigators that I had the chance to talk to from the state police says he's one of them that actually eyeballed the fact that these pictures, because they tried to pass the pictures off as being taken the night of. And the cup that they put the drink in still had ice in it when they took the pictures. So that's when the state police detectives realized this couldn't have been sitting there for several hours. this was reshot, and then they called out the Speedway police, and they finally owned up to it.
I wonder why the Speedway police decided to take those extra pictures and try to pass them off as evidence from the night of. That seems like a little weird.
It is. It's well, I think they realized
from somebody else, you know, who's listening here.
I think they realized that they had messed up, and they tried to do the best they could to go back and cover their tracks and not let anybody know just how much they had messed up. So not to completely absolve them, but it's just always been a point for me that I really don't think there was a lot of evidence to be found. You know, Jane Freet's car was moved as part of this crime. They have that. They inspected it as a crime scene.
It wasn't there, right?
Right. It was not at the restaurant. It was actually moved about a mile and a half away and parked very near the Speedway police station.
Oh, man. Okay. So we've made it through this recreation of it, right? The state police, what did the state police do then once they realized this was a retake?
So they really just disregarded a lot of the evidence from the crime scene. The crime then began basically from Jane Freet's car going forward, and then ultimately the evidence that they found in the field in Johnson County where the bodies were found. All four victims were found still wearing their Burger Chef uniforms, except for Daniel Davis had changed his shirt. So that's another clue that, again, kind of sets up our timeline, is it was most likely definitely after closing, because he had taken that action of
like he was going to go out and do something else.
Yeah, like he had plans after work, or that simply he didn't want to, because they were responsible for cleaning the restaurant, and most likely the boys were responsible for doing more of the gruntier, greasier type work, and so maybe he didn't want to get his uniform dirty. So
we know that the back door was open, and you said that the garbage can was empty. There's thoughts that someone saw them as they were maybe emptying the back in the back in the dumpster, and then somehow attacked them because they saw the door opening. There's also witnesses that say they saw someone around that area at the same time. Talk about that, what that part of the case is, because I find that very interesting.
It is a very interesting part of the case, and something that I think needs,
like, someone was spying on them,
right?
I mean,
to not get too deep into it,
sure.
That's kind of,
well,
my,
you can.
Right, that's kind of my feeling on it too, is that this was targeted, I think, more so than even the state police believe. You know, I don't think it was a simple robbery where just the restaurant was targeted. I think one of the victims was actually targeted, and they were waiting for them to make an appearance at that door that night. But to the other witnesses, there was actually a Dunkin' Donuts next door that was still open, and there was an employee who had taken a walk from her post at Dunkin' Donuts with her boyfriend, and they had walked around the Burger Chef restaurant. And at some point, upon returning back to the Dunkin' Donuts property, which was just a little bit to the west of the Burger Chef, they were approached by two men who apparently asked them for ID. Upon not being able to give them any ID or refusing to give them ID, they just told the kids, hey, you guys need to get out of here. There's been a lot of vandalism in the area. And apparently those are the exact words that were used. That's what's been re-quoted over and over again through these 42 years now.
No telephone action. Those were the words.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It seems to be.
There's been some vandalism around here, kids. You should probably get out of here.
Yeah. And it seems to me, you know, and you can draw a lot of inferences from a lot of pieces,
sure,
of evidence. Sounded to me like someone trying to sound like a cop. I mean, the asking for the ID, the mention of the vandalism. I don't know to what end, though. You know, and that's one of the things that I'm going to get into here with the further statements from these two witnesses, is sometimes we just had to decide that things weren't important and needed to be set aside, even though they were large parts of the lore of this case. And what I'm talking about specifically is there were two sketches created from the eyewitness statements of these two witnesses I just mentioned, and those were ultimately turned into two clay busts. And what we feel, and not only what we feel, but what we've heard from several investigators over the years, is that the sketches looked like everybody, and the busts looked like nobody. The sketches, they're often referred to as the bearded man and the fair-haired man, or the clean-shaven man. So the bearded man looked like at least 10,000 people running or men running around Indianapolis with a beard back in 1978, from, you know, your dad to your uncle to the guy with the motorcycle down the street. And so what happened was the police were just getting inundated with phone calls. Oh, I know a guy that looks like that. I ran into a guy that looks like that. My mom used to date a guy that looked like that. Mm-hmm. And he owned a gun or he owned a knife.
And that's just causing problems for the police department because they're now running around chasing leads that might not be real.
Right. So you've got to be careful with that. One of the other frustrating things is now this sketch doesn't get quite as much attention, but the fair-haired or clean-shaven sketch, there's actually a description given of both of these men. And he's described as neither fair-haired nor clean-shaven. He's said to have had a little stubble on his face, like he needed a shave, and to have had combed-over greasy black hair.
Ooh.
So these monikers get attached to him, but neither fit. So again, it makes it hard for people to remember people that they might have known who looked like that back in the day.
So if we close our eyes and we imagine the bearded man, and if you can go look at that sketch, that might be, you know, he obviously looks like everybody else. But then you add in a buddy that maybe he was hanging out with that had greased over comb black hair and a stubble. Maybe that'll just click in with somebody, you know. That's what we're hoping.
Well, and another thing about the description of the bearded man, he actually is described as having reddish brown hair.
Oh, my gosh.
It's a black and white sketch, so it's tough to portray that, I think. Mm-hmm. But he looks as if he has very dark, almost kind of salt and pepper type hair, like he's an older guy. But he was actually described as being around 30 years old, a little heavy set, and having reddish brown hair.
Interesting. So that happened around the same time that obviously those Dunkin' Donuts employees were taking a walk. And then you said, you know, like, I like what you said here, which is sometimes those are kind of pieces of a case that we get people hung up on, and it could really hurt the case more than anything. So far we've had two kind of big things happen, but no definitive answer in the terms of the recreation of the crime scene after it's been cleaned up. And then obviously these two men who the sketches aren't really helping. And then those busts, dude, I got to see the busts in person, and it's like, yo, they don't look like anybody. It looks like a high schooler put it together and tried to make a picture out of a sketch. But, and that sometimes is like we're saying, worse than actually doing nothing.
Yeah, and I think several investigators at least, agreed that releasing the sketches as early as they did, they were out to the public within 3 days of them coming out. So within 4 or 5 days of the abductions actually happening, didn't give the police time to work on any theories before it became all about the bearded man
or the leads that were coming in for the bearded man,
right?
Because then they have to put all their efforts there. Or at least a big chunk of it. There's a big thing too I find interesting is that if they took Jane's car, right? What kind of car was it?
No.
Tell me, because it was small.
It was, and that's another thing that the early theory seemed to be that everyone had piled into Jane's 1974 Chevy Vega.
Yeah, the Vega. That's right.
So,
if anybody sees this car, go look it up. I mean, it's not big at all.
It's a small two-door hatchback. You'd have trouble fitting four adults in there. And these kids were all average height. In fact, I think Jane was a little taller than your average female, at like 5'6 or 5'7. Mm-hmm. Mark Flemons was a taller guy, too. And then you've got, along with these four, two perpetrators. I think it would be very difficult, and I don't think we're alone in this, for one person to have pulled this off. So we're talking about shoving six average-sized teens and two adult males into this car. It just seems like a wild assertion.
Even if they try to shove them into the trunk, right? That's just a hatchback. You know, there might be some room back there. It's still two would have to fit back there for it to really make sense, or at least one.
Yeah, and I think, you know, even if they were doing it at gunpoint, this would have caused so much commotion that we've been told that there were, between employees and customers, about 8 to 10 people in the Dunkin' Donuts next door.
Mm.
So I think whatever...
Who'd you talk to for that?
So...
Did you ever get to talk to the Dunkin' Donuts people?
So I talked to a manager at the Dunkin' Donuts. He was a co-owner at the time, and he wasn't working that night, though. But mm-hmm. that was what he told me was the story he had always heard. So it was, I think it would have been 3 employees and 5 customers. We've actually met one of the customers who was there that night, but he doesn't recall a lot about what was going on inside the Dunkin' Donuts. He was actually pretty inebriated that night and had come to get a bite to eat to kind of settle himself.
Dunkin' Donuts, man. All I think about is coffee, which is a good time to get when you're inebriated.
Yep. Got coffee and a donut. And
yeah. So yeah, that's all. See, this is what I'm talking about, dude. And this is why I wanted to bring you on, because you've talked to these people, and that's what I find most interesting is when we're able to get in front of these people and hear from them themselves. Now, with that said, how much do you believe that eyewitness accounts are some of the most unreliable pieces of evidence that police deal with, right?
I believe that, and I think it's twofold. One, our eyes fool us all the time, and your brain can believe you saw something, and it's not quite right. The color was wrong, or the timing was wrong, or something like that, or the distance was wrong. And then a lot of what we've dealt with, not us, a lot of what investigators dealt with in the Burger Chef murders was people having a reason to tell a story, you know, wanting to get clout with a group of people outside of jail or prison, or actually wanting to get themselves some leniency when it came to a jail sentence or an upcoming hearing.
So is there another theory about the cars that you've run into?
So there's a lot of theories about the cars. The possibility that somebody was trying to steal the car and were planning to come back for it later. The most likely idea, I think, is because what doesn't get mentioned a lot is that Daniel Davis's car was also in the parking lot that night, but it wasn't taken. Very similar car, Ford Pinto, another small car. But it was parked on the Dunkin' Donuts side of the restaurant and mixed in more with the other cars that were in that parking lot, so it wasn't going to stand out. Jane's car was on the east side of the building, parked by itself. By taking that car out of there, to most people passing by, it's going to look like closed for business. Nobody's there, and nobody would have a reason to stop and see if something funny had gone on. So I think, and this was partially my thought, and I actually spoke with another law enforcement current private investigator who had the same theory, that they were just simply trying to buy time.
By taking her car.
They had another vehicle on the premises that was sufficient for moving everyone, be it a station wagon, a van, a large sedan, something like that. They simply were moving Jane's car because it stuck out like a sore thumb on the northeast corner of the building, and by moving it, they thought they would buy themselves some time.
You mean like no one would notice that the lights are on and all the cars are out of the parking lot, therefore, because that seems like it sticks out like a sore thumb, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I can't say for sure whether, because the former employees do tell me that it was customary that they would turn all the lights off, and so that was part of the oddities that they noticed as employees, but not so much. They don't believe that that would have stood out to other people in the public as they were driving by. I think the state police partially go along with that theory based on an interview I heard the current investigator in charge give, and it's not as compelling as the idea that they were all stuffed in the Vega or that there was some more nefarious reason, but it really seemed, coupled together with everything else, it seems to make the most sense.
What about, and obviously, my thought is there has to be another car because they can't fit in that Vega. So there has to be another car that they brought with them, hence the two people. And somebody took Jane's car, moved it, and where did they move it to again?
So they moved it, for anyone who's familiar with Speedway, to 15th Street, which is right across from Leonard Park and about a block and a half down from the Speedway Police Department, which is on Lyndhurst Drive as you go through Speedway.
Yeah, so they take that car. One of them drives it there. The other four are in the car with another person, and then they drive it, drop that car off. He gets picked up, and then on their way down to Johnson County. That's what, you know, in my head I go through. So
that's a very likely scenario. That's one that we certainly can't have ruled out. There's other possibilities that somebody dumped the car there and walked to another location or something like that.
But is there a theory that has been ruled out? Because at this point,
not Not specifically, no. And that's one thing that one of the investigators we've had a chance to communicate with has made it very clear is that, no, they haven't ruled anything out. They haven't eliminated any suspect over the years. Anyone else or anyone that's ever been mentioned is still fair game in this case. But we have tried to talk about the likelihoods and probabilities of certain theories and certain suspects along the ways.
So they're in the car, Johnson County. They go off this road off Route 31.
37.
Sorry, there's 31 and 37 down in Greenwood and around that area in Johnson County. Greenwood's in Marion County, by the way. But Johnson County, as soon as they go over the line, what did that do for police investigation? Because then it goes into a different county and a different jurisdiction.
Yeah, so this whole thing from the very beginning, early on when they thought it was just an abduction because they didn't find the bodies for 36 hours, after 24 hours, the FBI became involved. So it was the Speedway Police Department, probably a little help from Marion County Police Department and the FBI. Mm-hmm. They thought this was a quadruple abduction. Then around 2 p.m. on Sunday, about 36 hours after they were taken, the bodies are found by the landowners of the field down in Johnson County. And it's called into police. They get out there and they realize that these are the kids from the Burger Chef. And so at that point, it becomes a state police case because they cross county lines. So mm-hmm. that's just the typical way that it works. So for several months leading on into years, the FBI did stay a part of the investigation. Speedway Police Department, Johnson County Police Department, they would assign officers to task force that were set up by the state police and by the Marion County prosecutor. So they all kept their hands in it. I really feel that had the Johnson County Sheriff's Department played a bigger role in this case, it very likely could have been solved early on.
There's our third, you know, just kind of things that just kind of give a clip into the investigation that a bump, I should say, into the investigation. It causes problems.
So the thing about the state police is they have all the technology and all the training to interpret information that's gathered. Mm-hmm. But I think the location where these bodies were found is going to say a lot. If it's ever found out who did this, it's going to say a lot about who did this. Mm-hmm. Whoever did this had some connection to that field and that area of Johnson County. And I think the unit most likely to have been able to get at that information would have been the Johnson County Sheriff's Department.
Interesting. Great insight, man. That's awesome. Thank you. Obviously the murders were gruesome. We talked about that a little bit. And now for the first time in the last couple of years, we now know a picture of that murder weapon. It was actually broken off at the handle, which I found very interesting because that takes a lot of force. That's not something that happens to a blade easily.
No, it's a tough thing to imagine happening. There is some speculation, and I have to say this is coming to us from a previous investigator, but we've had no chance to look at any records or, you know, autopsy information ourselves, but speculation that
we have to know people to do that.
Right.
Me being a former reporter, I don't know that many people, but
and me
if
being,
you're listening out there, I'd love to see the information.
Right. And me being the most amateur of podcasters. there's some belief that Jane was moving and the break happened more from like the torque of maybe someone reaching around her to stab at her than just the straight on sheer force of stabbing into her chest.
And that's a huge clue that state police want you to focus on because anybody carrying that kind of stuff around, you know, when we're thinking about the guy with the beard, the reddish gray and black pepper hair, and then the guy with the combed over black hair and stubble. Think about those people. Imagine what they would be looking like, and then carrying the knife around. State police had hammered that in at that press conference 2 years ago.
Yeah, so they believe that whoever carried this knife, because it is a sizable knife, it's about a 4.5 to 5 inch blade, pretty thick. Looks very well worn. Looks like a knife they would have carried on them and used quite a bit. Believe they would have carried it in a sheath. We believe that's very likely. You know, the other alternative would be someone that carries a knife like that in a boot. just because that's a thing guys did at the time. But yeah, you would have known they were carrying it on them. It wasn't a pocket knife. It wasn't a kitchen knife that they just grabbed in the spur of the moment. It was a knife they intentionally carried on them and most likely did often.
Did they go right from the Burger Chef to the field in Johnson County after dropping off the car?
So that's an impossible question for us to answer. I can tell you what we think. And when I say
what you've heard too,
right. The belief of investigators is that, yes, they went straight to the field in Johnson County. The one thing that gives me a little bit of pause is the coroner, Johnson County coroner, put the time of death sometime between 3 hours and 6 hours after they last ate. The time of death was based on findings of, we believe, pizza that they had eaten that night in their digestive system. And the receipt for that pizza puts the purchase of it closer to closing time. So given, let's say they ate right at 11 o'clock. Let's say assistant manager, she can do whatever she wants. She goes and grabs a pizza right out, you know, right before closing. Everybody else, hey, you guys get to work. And she comes back and then they're all going to eat while they clean up. So let's say the earliest, right at 11 o'clock, they ingest this pizza. 3 hours later would be 2 a.m. Well, if we assume they were abducted at the latest at 11:50, it's not a 2 hour and 10 minute drive down to Johnson County. It's roughly a 35 to 40 minute drive between that Burger Chef restaurant and the field in Johnson County. So we're leaving open in our minds the possibility that there was some driving around done, or a middle location.
Very interesting. What do you think this case has done to the community years later, and really for police, from everyone you've talked to?
Well, the one thing that does get lost in stories like this, and not to in any way diminish what actually happened to the victims and the family members and friends closest to them, but this takes a toll on investigators. There are investigators who live with this still on an almost daily basis because it was their number one priority for most of their career, you know, from the time that it happened to the end of their career. I even spoke with one investigator who I caught up with, who lives down in Florida now, who he had just gotten off the phone with a former high up Burger Chef employee discussing this case just hours before I called, and he didn't know I was going to be calling. He wasn't boning up so he could talk to me. This is just something that comes up in his daily life at 80 years old. You know, so it definitely takes a toll. They get a lot of scrutiny, whether it's the Speedway Police Department for mishandling the scene in the beginning or just simply not finding answers, you know, now 40 years later. So certainly takes a toll there. As far as the town, it was interesting because when I first started talking to people about this, they would go into all of the crime that was going on in Speedway at the time, specifically the bombings. Mm-hmm. And again, like I said, they had a very nonchalant attitude about it. But when we finally got to talking about the Burger Chef case, their attitude changed. Mm. If they were young at the time, it could have been them. And a lot of young people, it did affect their lives anyway. You know, it controlled where and when they could go certain places because their parents were fearful, or what kind of jobs they could have. Kids were made to leave jobs that they enjoyed in the fast food industry, you know, and that was money. You know, when you're a kid,
yeah, you're getting your money.
Yeah, you want that money to go on dates or buy cool clothes or put gas in the car. And you know, now that's gone. You got to go find a new job that mom and dad approve of. So yeah, it's definitely taken a toll. And there's still people that live in Speedway that you know, when posts about this crime come up online, you'll inevitably see a few people who say, "Tear the building down." Mm. It's a terrible reminder. Tear the building down. So yeah, it's definitely had an impact.
That's great insight, man. And you know, are you gonna write a book or something, man? Like, I think you should write a book.
If I could find time, no, I would love it.
You might be an amateur podcaster, but you can be a professional writer.
Right, there you go. You know, I don't want to I don't want to call myself an expert, and I appreciate the kind words from
Listen,
you, but I don't
probably,
wanna...
You're probably the most versed person I've ever met at this. I wouldn't have invited you on here if I didn't believe in you. Not to mention, you know, we are part of our network. You are part of our network of Central State Studios. So you're close a close friend of mine now. So
and proud to be a part of it, for sure. But I think when you... I don't know, and maybe people see a podcast the same way, but, you know, there's been pirate radio as long as there's been radio, but I think when you write a book, you purport to be something and know something more than maybe what you really do. So I'm hesitant about that. But it's a story that needs to be told in every way possible. So if I felt it would make a difference, I mean, I would probably do it. I definitely could see myself writing a book about the experience, because as much as I've tried to share with you, there's been some wild moments. I was interviewing someone with some knowledge of the victims. Well, I'll leave it at that. And at one point during our conversation, he just started talking about, well, have you ever held a knife? Pulls a knife out of his pocket and proceeds to show me how he would hold the knife if he were the one to have stabbed Jane Freet. And
that's fun.
Yeah. So we're sitting, you know, in a fairly empty bar, and he starts poking the knife into the table. And
well, I have to tell you, in my bag, I brought a knife for protection.
You never know when we need.
I'm just kidding.
We're protection. In the library, in the public library. I'm not bringing.
Hey, I from that day on, I really started, you know, considered carrying a little something with myself. But
yeah, there's something that not many people know about podcasting. It can be dangerous.
It is. I should have done like a sports podcast or a kittens podcast.
Why
or
did you do it? What and you and I and the other Central State Studios podcast, we all kind of feel the same way about why we do this. But tell everybody that's listening my podcast why.
So the two main reasons were specifically with the Burger Chef case. There's a lot of information that's easily accessible in Facebook groups or YouTube videos or other podcasts. And I'm not trying to be hateful when I say this, because I think it's great anytime anybody talks about it, but so much of it is wrong. They just do the surface easy research and make a 40-minute podcast out of it, and that's it. And we just decided we were going to dive deeper, and we weren't going to put any information on the podcast that wasn't true unless we let you know, hey, we're speculating. We've gathered a lot of information, and now we're going to do some speculation.
And why is resourcing and sourcing so important, as some other podcasts don't do?
Well, for us, I mean, we have no prior, you know, laurels to rest on. And so for us, it was important for people to know that these aren't our words. I mean, we're not making this stuff up. You know, we're getting it from the Indianapolis Star, the Indianapolis News, from investigators. Now, we feel that we've built some trust in our audience, and there have been times I've had to give some information and say, hey, this came from an unnamed source. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we've been above board enough that, you know, that our listeners can go with us on that. And we haven't had any blowback or bad feedback on that. So I think we've done that, but I think you've got to build that trust first.
This is just a taste for everybody listening. And if you want to learn more, please head over to 3C Podcast. You can find information on centralstatestudios.com. You can also find it on 3cpodcast.com, right?
Yes, that's correct. And then we do a lot of our communication on Facebook, so facebook.com/3cpodcastindie.
Chris and I, a little background of where we are now and how excited we are to be together again here for this podcast to give it to you. First of all, the Burger Chef murders is a major case that I have yet to cover, so thank you. 1 year ago yesterday, I started my podcast. So we are past, you are officially year two, the first podcast in year two. So thank you again, Chris, for coming in.
We feel quite honored. Maybe you'll help us make it to our 1 year anniversary coming up in April.
And then, yeah, well, we have a big event coming up in April, Circle City Crime, Central State Studios. Oh no, Central State Studios. Yeah, that's us.
Yeah.
But Cold Case Chronicles, Hoosier Homicides, and Infamous Indie, the four podcasts that you heard there are all combining our efforts, and we're becoming Central State Studios, all Indiana true crime from all of four of us. And our passion is trying to change people's lives. That's why you listen to my podcast, because I'm trying to give you give people the voice that you can understand and listen to. It's literally why we do this, is to make a difference. So for the first time on April 18th, on a Saturday afternoon, Murder at the Vogue, it's our event. Dude, you helped us put this on. I mean, how excited are you that we get to do this?
Very excited. I had started talking about doing some kind of small event in a coffee shop or a brewery or something.
Nah, screw that, bro.
I had a serendipitous run-in with the event coordinator at the Vogue, and she pitched the Vogue, and I said, you don't have to pitch me on the Vogue. I just, you know, how can I pitch you on us possibly, you know, getting enough people in the Vogue? So you guys all out there have to help us with that, and it's going to be a fun time, but we're going to talk about some important stories that need to stay alive here and mm-hmm. need to be a part of the discussion with changing the way people talk about this stuff and the way things get policed here in the state of Indiana.
Thanks again, Chris. Really appreciate it. Again, where can people go to listen to your podcast?
So we are the 3C Podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, iHeartRadio, most major podcast apps. And
you're probably right under my podcast if you're listening on Apple. Or
yeah, usually second billing to Infamous Indie.
No, just the podcast that you would like, not right. Second billing. Don't get crazy.
Amazing. Anything else you want to say?
I'll come up with something. You know, for us, like I said, this has been about trying to be a way to compile the most accurate information we can. Started with the Burger Chef murders. We did cover a couple more recent cases during our kind of off time, because we've reached a point in the Burger Chef case where we feel that we need to do some more serious off-the-mic investigation before we keep talking about it. And then we've actually just started a season 2. And it revolves around the Westside Park murders from Muncie, Indiana in 1985. Two good, innocent teens out on one of their first dates ever in a park that everybody prior to that point felt was very safe. In fact, there were about 8 to 10 other carloads of kids in the park that night. But these two were shot and killed in the car. Hardly any suspects over the years, no weapon found, and of course, no answers. A lot of family members still alive looking for answers, and we hope, again, to compile the right information and just get people talking again.
And another reason why, it's another example of why we're doing what we're doing. We just, honestly, guys, we just want to make a difference. We're not trying to make money on this. We're not trying to get famous. Although we are having a live show, which is a fun way to do it, but it just gets our message out, which is let's look at this differently. Let's learn from it. And from my perspective, I'm a history craze person. I love looking at history. I love touching history. Getting the fact that the Burger Chef building is still standing blows my mind. I would love to. I've been by it a bunch of times, but I've never gotten out of the car. So that's my next step. Maybe I'll do that after this. But you know, thanks again, man, and everybody. Thanks for listening. We really appreciate it. At the end of every podcast, I always say, stay safe. Chris, why don't you do it for me today?
And as always, stay safe.
There it is. Nice job. Thanks, buddy.
Hey, no problem.
It was my pleasure to bring Chris a fellow podcaster here in Indianapolis. You know, Chris and I are a part of the Central State Studios, and officially on April 18th, 2020, we're going to have a live show with Cold Case Chronicles, Hoosier Homicide, 3C's Podcast, and Infamous Indie. So you guys want to buy tickets? Head to The Vogue. Please go to The Vogue's website. You can buy tickets right now. You can buy them for $10 right now or $13 at the door. We're trying to sell out, yo. We're trying to sell out. We're trying to sell out our first show. It'd be so sick to see everybody and meet everybody. And hopefully everybody have some questions for us. There's going to be a question and answer portion. There's going to be an investigation portion. There's going to be an interview portion. Can you guess who's going to do the interview? Yeah, you already know it. So go to thevogue.com. You can also go to my Instagram page and click on the link in my bio. That's where you can buy your tickets. So guys, I hope you enjoy your week. I'll see you in a couple. I'm working on a couple big ones for you. definitely something that you guys would find very interesting. And it's crazy because it was a chance meeting. So I'll explain later. Go to the Infamous Indie Podcast Instagram page, Facebook page, and infamousindie.com. Thanks, everybody, for joining me. And as always, stay safe.